This episode is brought to you by Aircraft Accessories of Oklahoma. When it's time for an aircraft component inspection, overhaul, repair, or replacement, you need experienced technicians you can trust and friendly service you can count on. Aircraft Accessories of Oklahoma, a family-owned business since 1959, delivers just that.
Our techs have real-world experience and provide sales, service, and overhaul for piston engine aircraft accessories. We also have limited turbine capabilities such as fuel pumps, starter generators, and prop governors. And we can overhaul propellers ranging from fixed pitch to turbine. Propeller pickup and delivery service is available. And one more thing, mention this podcast to receive 5% off your next sale, service, or overhaul. Visit aircraftaccessoriesofok.com.
This is producer David O'Leary with a quick reminder to our listeners. For the next few months in 2024, we will be releasing several remaining episodes featuring the late Richard McSpadden, including today's episode. We hope you enjoy this edition of There I Was.
So I'm pitching for best glide speed. He's talking to ATC, telling them we can't maintain altitude, at which point we're now maybe 25-ish, 100 feet above the ground. And I tell my buddy, I said, look, my multi-engine training sort of kicked in because I'm sitting here going, oh, this is fix or feather moment, right? We're below 3,000 feet, you know, we're feathering the prop and we're landing. This isn't a fixed point anymore. Let's concentrate on the landing and let's make sure we can put this thing down. So I said, declare the emergency, we're going in that field.
Welcome to another edition of There I Was, a podcast where we put you in the cockpit with pilots in demanding situations and we learn how they flew out of them. I'm your host, Richard McSpadden. Today, we have Jared Yoshiki. Jared Yoshiki is the Western Pacific Regional Manager for AOPA, so you folks out in the Western Pacific region will deal with Jared if you have any kind of issues associated with your flying environment, airport, or any other way in the environment. Jared is a GA pilot since about 2017. He's only got about 300 hours, but in that 300 hours, he's commercial, IFR, multi-engine rated. And he's going to share with us a story about buying his first airplane, a Cherokee 180, and ferrying it back from Kokomo, Indiana to Sacramento, California, when he had an engine problem and had to deal with it. Jared, welcome to the There I Was podcast.
Great to be here, Richard. Thank you.
It's good to have company traffic on the There I Was podcast.
Indeed. It's a pleasure to tell the story and hope it can help some other pilots, as maybe some student pilots out there, or maybe some GA pilots, just see that it can happen to anybody at any time.
So, Jared, share with us your story and a little bit about the background. You had just purchased this Cherokee 180, right? So pick it up from there and tell us all about it.
Yeah, just picked up a 1966 Cherokee 180 out of Kokomo, Indiana, and brought along my old flight instructor buddy to ferry it back to California with me, and first airplane that I've ever owned in my life. So we flew out to Indiana, picked it up at Kokomo, Indiana, did a pretty extensive pre-flight. We had never seen this airplane before. I had never touched it ever since purchasing it.
Well, let me ask you, so did you find it off of like a Barnstormers or Trader Plane or one of those? Explain to us the buying process. You had never seen it, but it was already your airplane?
Correct. So I found it on Trader Plane, and I was actually working through AOPA's financing folks to try and purchase the plane, and was working with the aircraft valuation. I think his name was Mike Jacobs out in Minden, Nevada.
Okay.
And he was kind of counseling me on different planes to look for, you know, stay away from the really expensive Cessna 172s, which everybody seems to want for flight training, try and maybe look into a Mooney or something like that. But I wasn't too comfortable with the retractable gear thing. And so I found this Piper Cherokee with, you know, just about 2,600 hours on Trader Plane. And I sent it to Mike to take a look at it. And he said, I'll tell you what, Jared, if this is the plane you want, stop what you're doing, call the seller, and buy this airplane.
You know, Cherokee 180, so the first airplane I owned was a Cherokee 140, actually. And I bought it to actually teach my son to fly, and it was a fantastic platform for teaching him to fly. And we kept that for a little bit over a year, so that was my first airplane too.
You know, and everybody I had talked to prior to even purchasing this plane said, don't discount a Piper Cherokee. If you find a Piper Cherokee 180 or 150, get it, because they will be your best friends. They are great airplanes, not even just to train in, but to also fly in, especially if you've got one with 180 horsepower to get over the mountains, give you some altitude, et cetera. You know, you'll enjoy having it in California with all the great weather, and you'll get places fairly quickly, you know, instead of sitting in a Cessna 152 or, you know, a small.
Yeah. So I agree with you. I was thinking when I had that 140, it only had the 150 engine in it. And I remember thinking, man, I should have stepped up and bought the 180, because that's just a much better airplane with that 180 horsepower.
Yeah. And I just got lucky.
So you find it and you talk to the finance guy and he says, buy it. So how'd you buy it? You arranged for a pre-buy, you said?
I did, arranged for a pre-buy. And let me tell you, that was a process. very few people out in middle America with a lot of aviation credentials to do something like this. And so it was a little trying. And like everybody says, you know, try and find an unconflicted, you know, IA or AP to come out and do it, which was a little hard considering, again, you're working with a small group of people. But we eventually got somebody who had enough credentials that were a little separate to go in and do it. And the pre-buy turned out great. There was nothing, no corrosion on the airplane. He checked, bore scoped the engines, make sure there was, you know, nothing wrong with anything in the cylinders, the push rods, any of that stuff. Checked all of the ELT, make sure the all of the lines and the cords and everything was tip-top shape. I asked him to check landing gear, you know, make sure there was nothing wrong on the inside of the landing gear, because I had read something about corrosion on some of the bolts. Nothing. So pre-buy turned out clean. There were definitely some issues that needed to be repaired, but the folks I worked with out there, the seller, said, I'll take care of all of them.
Wow.
Don't worry about it. The only one he didn't take care of was the seatbelt.
Yeah. It is a little bit of an intimidating process your first time through it, though, isn't it? Because most of the time you see an airplane on, I'm on my fifth airplane now, but you see it through Barnstormers or Trade a Plane, and it's usually remote. It's usually somewhere far away. So now you have to somehow get eyes on it or get a maintenance person to do a pre-buy that a lot of times you've never met, don't know. So there's just a whole lot of unknowns in the process, isn't there?
Absolutely. And the hardest, and beyond the pre-buy, the biggest problem I ran into is actually trying to get somebody out to go do a pedostatic inspection because it was out of currency. So I had to get somebody all the way from Ohio to drive across into Indiana to do the pedostatic test just to make sure that my plane was airworthy and I could even take off once I was getting there. So that was a big challenge.
And then, you know, so there's the one aspect of do the pre-buy to make sure it's mechanically sound and the airframe is sound, no corrosion and all that. But a whole other piece of the pre-buy that can get very expensive in buying a used airplane is to go through the logbooks and know the airworthiness directives and whether or not the previous owners have complied with all those ADs. Because if they haven't, that gets really expensive.
Absolutely. And when I was working with the pre-buy, the mechanic who was checking out the airplane, that was my top priority for him, was I want to make sure all of the aircraft airworthiness directives were complied with. If there's one that's not complied with, please tell me and let's talk about it. And gratefully, everything checked out.
Yeah.
He said even the most recent AD, which was you had to have an access panel under the underside of the wing so that you could check the landing gear. There was an access panel there. And he's like, that AD had been complied with. That was the most recent one. And all of the other ones checked out. So I got real lucky. Like I said, I got real lucky.
Yeah, that's nice. It's a comforting feeling. But, you know, that mechanical airframes are worthy. And then all the ADs are complied with. So now what I found in searching buying airplanes is, you have all this list of things you want. You want a low-time airplane, but you want it to have flown a fair amount recently. You don't want any corrosion. You want any damage history. You want full logbooks. And then those are unicorns. Those kind of airplanes are really hard to find. So then you kind of have to sort of back off of this or that and say, okay, I'll trade this or that, or, you know, do some negotiating on the price. I got to where I enjoyed the whole process, but the first couple times, too, it was a little bit intimidating.
I was totally intimidated. the first thing that was said to me was to make sure that the airplane had full logs. And that was the great part, is it had all the logs. The one thing I did have sacrifice on just a little bit was flight time in recency. It was it had probably been sitting in Michigan, which is where the seller had picked it up from, maybe for about 7-8 months, but it had been flown before that, about 20 hours before that. But the fact that I had a fairly freshly overhauled engine, it was overhauled at a little over 2,000 hours. So it was 600 hours into its new overhaul, which was great, because after reading Mike Bush's great books about engine overhauls and things like that, and looking at all of his analytics and data, where he says, you know, usually that first 600 hours-ish after an overhaul is, you know, when that, I don't say the accident curve usually is, as he calls it, or I think that's what he calls it. So I was kind of impressed that we were at 642 hours since major overhaul, and total airframe time was still only 2,600 hours. So I was pretty happy with the low airframe time. It was just out of overhaul. I knew I had another about 1,400-ish hours to fly it. So if I was truly going to go to the airlines and try and build hours, I had my quote-unquote training aircraft right there to complete up to 1,500. So
yeah, so good. So the pre-buy goes well. Looks like you've got yourself a good airplane. So you fly out to Kokomo with your instructor. And what happened?
So we get out to Kokomo, get to the airfield in the morning, and because neither of us had seen this airplane or flown it, we probably spent a good hour and 20 minutes pre-flighting the airplane. I mean, we checked for everything. We were making sure there was oil. We were making sure the oil was clean, at least not very dark or dirty. I mean, we went all the way down to checking the tire pressure just to make sure we had the right PSI in the wheels. We opened every access panel if we could. We ripped the cowling off, made sure all the hoses looked right and were attached correctly. And we checked everything. We flipped on all the lights, made sure all the lights work, wanted to make sure our fuel gauges were reading at least something in the tanks. It was an hour. It was a good hour, if not hour and a half pre-flighting, before we even told the guy to pull the plane out of the hangar and take us over to fuel so we could fuel the plane up and get ready to go. We wanted to make sure everything, at least on the outside, looked amazing.
Yeah, so you've got a big trip ahead of you, and it's in an airplane that's completely unknown to you. So you're going from Kokomo, Oscar Kilo Kilo, to Sacramento, Sierra Alpha Charlie, pretty much across the entire country. First time you've ever flown this airplane that's brand new to you. So yeah, I'd take a little bit of time on that pre-flight.
Yeah, we didn't want to take we're not going to take anything for granted, you know. Well, yeah, sure, we had some people look at it and all that jazz, but we wanted to make sure everything worked out. And the funny part about this is, even after the pre-flight, so we fill up the plane, loaded both tanks, and we turn on the airplane, and hit a heading indicator just starts to spin. Suction gauge is reading zero, and we're going, this is not a good start. And so we taxi the plane back to the hangar and say, hey, what's wrong? Heading indicator spinning. Vacuum gauge isn't working, possibly vacuum failure. And so we shut off the airplane. The guy's like, oh, the guy just didn't attach the hose of the vacuum back into the firewall. Hmm. There was no air going into the airplane on the suction gauge. We're like, well, at least we know maybe it works. Sure enough, plug it back in and fired it up, and everything worked fine at that point. Suction gauge read clean and heading indicator worked perfectly fine. So yeah. That was kind of funny.
Yeah, but it also illustrates a point that most of the time, our equipment is so incredibly reliable. Most of the time when it breaks, it's some kind of human error in the break. And that's Mike Bush's one of his whole premises, is that the reason you don't want to do all this invasive maintenance, major surgery, he calls it, is because there's so much opportunity for human error. And you want to try to eliminate that if you can.
I completely agree. And that's why I thought reading his book before we even went out to Indiana was so important, because the human error factor, you just don't consider it when you're thinking about it, because it's a machine. And so you just expect the machine to work as it was built, and that the human error factor is going to be, oh, well, yeah, I took out that screw, I'll make sure and put it back. Well, sometimes you forget. And it's just those little things that can just sometimes create a really big problem. So I was really glad we caught that one while we were on the ground.
Yeah. So, okay. So you reconnected the vacuum hose, you're taxiing out, and heading indicator's working fine. And yep. So then what?
So then on our drive to the airport, we had kind of looking at weather. And like you mentioned earlier, the idea of we kind of blew more a southerly direction than a western direction. And a lot of that was because this was late April. So we were starting to get some thunderstorms along the Mississippi River. And we decided, hey, let's not fly into those things. It's probably a smart idea. So we decided to fly south first and then take the southern route back across Texas as we were going to head back to California.
Got it. So I'm curious, was the plane IFR certified or not? Or were you guys planning a VFR trip the whole way? Or what was your thinking there?
It was not IFR certified. Okay. We were planning a VFR trip the whole way, which is a little bit why we picked late April, early May-ish, because we thought we could avoid at least hopefully thunderstorms along the southwest. And yeah, that was really why we picked that time frame.
Okay, good. So you got to, right off the bat, you just got to route a little bit south to get around some thunderstorms and off you go.
Correct. And, you know, we had the POH on our southwest flight out to Indianapolis, and, you know, we were reading our POH. It's like, okay, we should have about 10 gallons per hour should be our fuel economy. Our first stop should really be to test that. And so we picked a stop in Illinois that was just about an hour and a half away to test our fuel economy. We dipped both tanks, make sure we were full on each side, 25 on each side. And so we taxied out to the runway, did want to make sure we understood the controls a little bit and how everything worked, and took off. And we figured we were going to take this hour to also play around with the airplane to get a sense of how it felt. You know, what did the controls feel like? Was it really, really touchy? You know, how did the throttle work and things like that? So this first hour and a half was really meant to truly get an idea of how this airplane flies and handles in the air.
Yeah.
So that we can feel comfortable with what it's like.
I like what you're planning too, in that it's an airplane new to you. So you're going to take off, and only after an hour and a half, you probably have 3.5-4 hours, you know, of legs if you wanted to. But after an hour and a half, they'll give you enough time to switch through both of your fuel tanks to make sure both of them are going to feed for you. Just check out all the systems and then land and fill it up and, you know, see what the indicators are reading. And just kind of get some general essay about how your plane operates, how the fuel tanks read and all that, right? That's what's in your mind.
Exactly. And that first hour and a half was really telling. I mean, we started to make a list of things that maybe we should have fixed at some point in my ownership of this airplane. You know, I think we noticed that the fuel gauges would stick. So you would turn on the airplane and normally they would immediately jump in a normal airplane. Well, this one, sometimes the needle would stick a little bit. And so my co-pilot and I and my buddy said basically, hey, let's flag that. So when you land, maybe somebody can kind of take a look at that and see if there's maybe the needle's hitting the window or something, and it just needs to kind of be reset or something like that. So we were making these little notations kind of as we were going. But the big thing, yeah, was really to test out the airplane. Are we getting what the POH says we should be getting with fuel economy, knowing that we've got another 2,000 plus miles to fly to the west?
Yeah, so, and you get to cross over some pretty big rocks along the way too, by the way.
Bingo. So, bingo.
Yeah. Nice to shake all that stuff out before you get there.
Exactly right. We don't want any quote unquote surprises, right? So yeah, we made that hour and a half flight down to Kearney, Illinois, and made our notations. We even did a nice little crosswind landing because it was kind of off of our little bit quartering headwind a little bit. So we got to see how the plane handled when it landed, which was fine. Filled up our tanks, and then we went back to our flight planning again, say, okay, what are we doing here? The weather was still kind of building along the Mississippi. So I said, well, let's just shoot for 2 hours, 45 minutes. We know what our fuel economy is. And let's go to Greenville, Mississippi would be our night stop, where we would stop for the night, tie it down and leave the next morning and start west. And so we were doing great. The plane was functioning amazingly for the first 2.5 hours. And we were about half an hour away from Greenville, Mississippi. You know, I'm kind of taking pictures of the Mississippi River and stuff like that. It was about maybe an hour or so before sundown or sunset.
And while you're doing that, I'm just curious, brand new airplanes, you're always a little nervous, you know, did I buy the right airplane? Is it all right? Are you getting a good feeling like as you're cruising, especially on that second leg, that, yeah, the airplane is what I thought it was and feeling pretty good about this?
I was amazed at how easy the airplane was to fly. Having really been brought up through the Cessna 172 world and whatnot, the last Piper aircraft I flew was the Seminole as a multi-engine, but I was amazed at how similar it handled and how I got more comfortable flying the airplane as I went. So yeah, I mean, it was, how can I put this? It was enlightening to know that I felt I had a very competent aircraft that I would feel safe taking myself and my wife, yeah. You know, if we wanted to go somewhere, and that I would be safe flying somewhere in it. I felt really comfortable. I didn't feel I bought a lemon, in other words.
Yeah, right. Good. That's a good feeling. Yeah. So you're inbound, you're cruising along the Mississippi, taking some pictures, and what happened?
So we had noticed, you know, our ground speed wasn't too good. We were taking a little bit longer. And so we were kind of looking at altitudes to see maybe where the headwind wasn't as strong. And by the way, we're only flying at maybe 6,000 feet. So we're not very high. Obviously, there's not a lot of high stuff down there. That's pretty flat. But, you know, we were up there a little bit and noticed that the wind was a little calmer as you got lower. And so we said, hey, you know, let's descend, because, you know, maybe we can get a little better ground speed by descending. And so we went down to about 3,000 feet after passing Memphis and getting around there. So we were about 3,000 feet, and I just happened to be scanning instruments, looking outside for landing spots. And I just happened to notice my fuel pressure was at zero. And this was about 30 minutes before landing at Greenville, Illinois. So we were getting ready, going through before landing checklists and stuff like that. We had just switched tanks to the fullest tank, and the checklist says, you know, fuel pump on, switch the tank, leave the fuel pumping on until you see the fuel rate stabilize, fuel pressure stabilize, and then you turn the boost pump off. So we had done all that. And then I look over and the fuel pressure is at zero. And I'm like, well, that's not good. Immediate instinct, fuel pump on, boost pump on, and verify fullest tank.
But the first thing you noticed was the gauge. You didn't notice a rough running engine or anything. You've just first noticed no fuel pressure. Well, that's interesting.
Correct.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that was what was at the end, you know, is what's seemingly interesting, because I looked at the RPMs and our RPMs are still kind of holding, but then they started to waver. Mm. It was at that point that I hit the boost pump, and then they, you know, that's when I noticed the RPM starting to drop a little bit. And it was at that point we're trying to say, like, well, how much fuel do we have? Gauges are reading, you know, 16 gallons or 12 gallons in one side and 8 gallons in the other. So we knew we had plenty of fuel on board to reach Greenville. It was just a matter of, why did we all of a sudden lose our fuel pressure? And more importantly, if our fuel pressure is at zero, why didn't our engine stop?
Yeah.
You know, okay. Why do we still?
That's what I'm asking. It's like, you know, okay, if you got no fuel pressure. And that would have been my first thought, was if you just happen to look down and see no fuel pressure and your engine's running fine, I got a bad gauge.
Yeah. And the next thing was, my buddy said to me, he was like, well, do you think the gauge is bad? And I'm like, no, because we still have a little bit of RPM. So it could be the gauge, but we're only 3,000 feet up. Let's try and fix what's going on here. So he did notice that our mixture still was a little out. We had leaned our mixture while we were at altitude, but didn't really push it all the way back in. It was still a little out. So my buddy just went, all right, let's just go full rich on the mixture and see what happens. It didn't change the scenario. Meanwhile, we're looking for landing spots, trying to find an empty field if we've got to put it down, because we're not really able to maintain 10 altitude at this point, because I think we had about, we're about 1,300 RPMs, I think, now.
And that's the max you could get out of it, 1,300 RPMs.
Correct.
Yeah. So, Jared, let me catch up to you. So just to make sure I understand the sequence, you're flying along, you had descended to lower altitude, getting ready to land, so you flip on the boost pump, change your fuel tank, and then you notice low fuel pressure and your RPM starts winding down. Is that the right sequence?
It was, yeah, there was probably about good five-ish, maybe not quite 10 minutes after we had switched tanks that it happened.
Okay.
That's when we noticed the RPM drop.
Okay, got it. Okay.
So to us, there was really nothing happening in that 5 to 10 minute span.
Yeah.
And immediately once we see the event happen, it's okay, mixture full rich, verify Rich's tank, verify we have fuel on board. We do. My buddy says, okay, you fly the plane. Let's get best glide speed. Let's find a landing spot. I'm like, Roger, I've got brown field over here with tractors on it. Let's make sure we land. If we're going to put this thing down in a field, let's make sure we land near people. And there were a bunch of tractors doing furrows in the field. So we picked that as our landing spot. And the other thing is, we also wanted to turn to the east to get away from the river, so that we, you know, eliminate the water as a landing spot. So let's get over dry land. And so I'm pitching for best glide speed. He's talking to ATC telling them we can't maintain altitude, at which point we're now, I'm going to say maybe 25-ish, 100 feet above the ground. Mm. And I tell my buddy, I said, look, my multi-engine training sort of kicked in because I'm sitting here going, oh, this is fix or feather moment, right? We're below 3,000 feet. You know, we're feathering the prop and we're landing. This isn't a fixed point anymore. Let's concentrate on the landing and let's make sure we can put this thing down. So I said, declare the emergency. We're going in that field. So he jumps on the radio, contacts ATC and says, hey, we're declaring emergency and loss of engine power. And what was interesting is the moment we turned to the east and got out of that little bit of headwind, we actually gained a little RPMs, which was interesting. Hmm. We didn't know why.
Yeah.
Because I looked at him and was like, dude, we just got RPMs back. And so we started to climb because I said, well, I'm going to get some altitude. If I got some RPMs, I'm going to try and get all I can, you know, before it potentially quits on you. Meanwhile, the boost pump is still on. We're still on the fullest tank. And then we lose the RPMs again. Hmm. So we start our turn, you know, back to the south. We're trying to set up for this soft field landing. And again, declares the emergency, trying to give position reports as we're going. And we tell them we're about 6 nautical miles-ish from Cleveland, Mississippi. And then we kind of look at each other and he looks at me and says, do you want to take the landing? And I look at him saying, asking the same question. And I look at him, I said, you know what? You don't have tow brakes on your side of the plane. So you take the landing because let's eliminate one factor of a problem for a soft field landing, which could be to flip the plane over if you tap brakes. So he says, fair enough. So I said, I'll control the magnetos and the electrics. You tell me when you want the prop to stop. You've got the landing. He goes, fair. Probably about 50-ish feet above the ground. He's like, all right, kill the prop. Magnetos go off. Master switch goes off. The prop stops spinning. And maybe 10 seconds-ish later, main wheels hit right in the furrows. And we just kind of roll ourselves out. And plane comes to a complete stop in the middle of a soybean field in Shelby, Mississippi, with relatively no damage to the plane, not that we could see. We both got everything off and ran out of the plane like we're taught to do just in case the plane catches on fire. Yeah, it was a very crazy 5 minutes.
Wow. And how was the landing? How smooth was the field? Because, you know, there's that old adage, if it looks rough, it is. If it looks smooth, it might be.
Yeah.
Right. How smooth was it?
It wasn't. I mean, it was definitely a plowed field.
Yeah.
It was furrowed. So they were getting ready to plant. But in our, I'll give ourselves credit for landing with the furrows. I mean, mm-hmm. the way the FAA put it, when we showed them the pictures, they said, wow, you guys even landed with the furrows, you know? You guys must do this often, or you must be really experts at soft field landings and stuff like that. So we were pretty impressed my buddy's skill to put it in the furrows. But
were you ever worried about, as you land in touchdown, was it bumpy? Were you ever worried about the potential of nosing over, or was that never really a factor?
Honestly, I can't say that I remember, but I don't ever remember sitting in the cockpit while the plane was kind of touch the dirt, ever being really frightened about what was going to happen next. I think our crew resource management between my buddy and myself, we had talked everything through. We knew exactly what we were going to do and how we were going to do it. And the only thing we could do was put our faith and our trust in our training and really remember what we were supposed to do. And my buddy put it right down in the field and never once did I touch the brakes. In fact, I wasn't even on the pedals. I pulled my feet back as far as I could. And we just kind of let the plane bounce.
Yeah.
And we kept the yoke back as much as we could just to keep the nose wheel off. And
So you did a true soft field landing technique, did you?
Yep, soft field landing technique right into the field.
Yeah,
right nice. Into the field.
Nice. Well, you know what? So nice job to both of you on a job well done there. I mean, it seems now, you know, in hindsight, because you guys made it look easy that, you know, it was all okay. But those kinds of situations, as we know, can go disastrously wrong. And so you guys did a nice job controlling that whole situation. You know, and it starts with, you said you flicked the tanks over. And then about 5 minutes later, you know, you noticed this no fuel pressure decelerating RPM. So it took out the equation. You know, we're all kind of taught that if you flick a switch and something bad happens, unflick it, right? The first thing you do is go back and unflick whatever switch you just flicked. But in this case, it had been 5 minutes. So that wouldn't necessarily come to mind, which it did. And I'm curious, did you try that? Did you try switching tanks?
Honestly, no. And that would be one thing that I arguably probably should have thought of at the time. And it was a learning experience for me for that. But honestly, because we were really low and we were already 3,000, we were only 3,000 feet up, mm-hmm. and we were really just preparing to land, the last thing I wanted to do was potentially try and land on a tank that may have had a half an hour worth of fuel in it, 45 minutes worth of fuel in it, let's say. So, there was that hindsight of, yeah, maybe I should have tried to flip the tank back to the other side. But at the same time, it was more of, let's get a handle on what's actually happening. You know, we're losing RPMs, we can't maintain altitude, and we're only 3,000 feet high. So that just something that never crossed my mind was to flip it back.
Hey, David, I got a riddle for you. How can you upgrade your next flight without upgrading your airplane?
I think upgrading the pilot would be the first clue for that one.
The guy between the headsets, huh? Yeah.
That's right.
All right. That's not what I'm talking about, but I'll give you a clue. It has ADS-B traffic and weather, Sirius XM weather and entertainment, no wires, and it works with 4Flight and Garmin Pilot.
Oh, Ian, I know what that is. It's the Garmin GDL-52 Sirius XM portable weather receiver.
Yeah, that's right. Okay. And now, believe it or not, the Garmin GDL-52 comes with a 3-month trial of Sirius XM aviation weather and a very special limited time $400 rebate. Learn more about all that this receiver can do and the limited time $400 rebate by visiting sporties.com/GDL52.
So you mentioned something that I wanted you to elaborate on, and that is at some point for you, it seems like it was below 3000 AGL, you went into a totally different mental paradigm where you said, okay, your multi-engine training kicked in below this altitude, you either fix it or feather it so you can reduce drag and, you know, so forth. In your mind, it seems like you made that shift. So I'm not going to worry about fixing this thing anymore. I'm going to focus entirely on my best off airport landing.
Correct. And that was just, it was fresh because I was in multi-engine training, I believe at the time, or just finishing with multi-engine training. And so that mindset was already in my head of, if you're losing an engine and flying the Seminole, what's your altitude? Obviously you're looking at, you know, maintain pitch, attitude, airspeed, and then you're okay, what's my altitude? Am I above 3000 or below 3000? And then if you're below 3000, feather the prop to eliminate drag and land the plane. And so it was just a natural thought process. It wasn't a question. It was just a natural thought process I put myself in of, okay, we got to put the plane down. Let's stop trying to fix it. And let's make sure we can land safely. And let's try and pick a good spot, because the longer we go down this route of trying to troubleshoot, it could put us in a different situation. And there are trees, you know, that are around those fields that would have made an off-field landing or off soft field landing much more difficult. And so I said, we have the opportunity right here. You know, let's not waste it by trying to figure out potentially what's going on, because we don't have that much time.
I think that is a big factor in this situation and in others. You made the decision early, so now you've got time. You're in a crisis situation. Your engine can't hold altitude, but you've just bought yourself a lot of time because you can use all that altitude to just slow down and think, right? And that, it gave you options to choose the field that you wanted to move away from the river, to do the crew coordination that you guys were talking through. All of that gets taken away if you wait too long to handle your situation, right?
Yep, I totally agree. I couldn't have asked for a better buddy to fly with in this case, because we had flown so much during instrument training that it was just very natural. Our communications were very calm. It was very natural. And if we made a decision to do something, there was no question. It was just, okay, we are going to feather the prop, or we are going to do a soft field landing. All right, let's turn to the east. Let's get ourselves lined up with that field. So I completely agree. It just gave us more time to kind of slow the situation down a little bit, so we're not rushed in trying to, you know, really quickly adapt to a changing situation.
And in the case of you two, the decision to who to land the airplane had nothing to do with ego or anything else. It had everything to do with how you assessed the best pilot to handle it was based on where they were in the airplane. And in your case, you decided it was a brake issue. You wanted somebody without brakes to just take that out of the equation. So just, again, nice, methodical, logical thinking as you thought through your options.
Yeah, I mean, my buddy has, you know, he's off to the airlines now. But that was definitely something that was part of the process, was obviously he has more hours, but that really wasn't the factor, like you mentioned. It really was the brake thing. I knew he didn't have brakes on his side and that it would just eliminate an equation or a circumstance off of what was going to potentially about to happen in the next 5 to 10 minutes. And if you start eliminating bad things, you know, hopefully that equates to good things.
So what did happen? Why did the RPM start rolling back? So you all the way to touchdown, except for when you decided to shut the engine off, you had some engine power, right? Up to 1300 RPM, I think you said, not enough to hold level flight. So you had some engine power. So what caused that rollback of the engine?
So when we talked to the FAA, they wanted us to bring a mechanic to the field we landed in before they would allow us to basically fly it out. And I'll tell you that end of the story also later, because that's a very sweet part of this story. But when the mechanic got out there the following morning, he noticed in the air intake that there was some rubber insulation on the inside of the cowling that I think protects the air intake from, you know, rocks or debris or stuff like that. But it was loose and it was kind of flapping around. In fact, he was able to pull a good, I don't know, maybe foot size piece out of the cowling before he actually ripped it all out. And he said, I wonder if possibly you had just the right airspeed, just the right amount of headwind, and just the right angle to that headwind, that rubber piece was covering your air filter where you were starving your engine of air. And it would make a little sense that when you went to full rich, you actually had an overly rich mixture, which means you weren't getting, you know, enough bang for your buck, if you will, and which really never caused you to lose power because you were just kind of starving your engine of air, but you were losing RPMs and weren't producing as much thrust anymore. And so he goes, that could be part of it. What it actually ended up being, because we decided at the time to basically leave the plane in Mississippi because it was due for an annual in June anyway. And I said, look, we just landed in a field. It's due for an annual in June. Let's like a proper mechanic take a look at it at an airport. Let's let them rip apart the fuel tanks and stuff like that and, you know, really do a good inspection on this thing. So what ended up happening was during the annual, the mechanic ripped out my fuel tanks and actually found sediment, not normal sediment that you could normally get through the quick drain, but trash, as he called it. And it was covering up the fuel screen on the inside of the fuel tanks. And he said it was big enough where it wouldn't have gone through the fuel quick drain valve, number one. But number two, it was also big enough that where it had settled on the fuel screen, it would have covered almost, he said, about 80 to 90% of the screen itself. He goes, so if you were getting fuel into the engine, it was very, very little that was being pulled through the tank. So he goes, that's the only other thing I could add to this that would make it seem as though you were losing engine power and what caused you to lose the engine power and why you had to put it in the field. There was nothing else outside of that.
Okay, so I've always wondered this too. You land your airplane in a field. Everybody's safe. You're good. Now you have a maintenance technician come out and look at the airplane. How do you get it out?
Oh, I had some choice words, considering it was my first airplane and we were standing in the field and the sun was about to go down. And now that we were safe, it was now the more maddening part of, well, what the heck do I do now? I mean, I can't just call AAA and have them tow it out of the field. And that's where the best part of the story is in my mind, not to mention, obviously, we landed safely, but the people who were in Shelby, Mississippi, the crop dusters who flew over us and kind of puffed some smoke to let us know that they saw us, that they were talking to law enforcement, the tractors who stopped to make sure we were okay and who radioed to their farm boss, you know, to come out and take a look at us, the family that came out to take us to our hotel that night, et cetera. What we did was they said, well, hey, it's supposed to rain tonight. So there was probably 1, 2, 3, 4 5 sheriff's deputies from the county that came to us, plus the crop duster, plus the tractor drivers who helped us push the plane out of the furrows to put it on a flat spot of ground that was more solid so it wouldn't sink in if it rained. That was that night we landed. The day after, when the mechanic came out, we actually had one of the tractor drivers brought his truck out, and we actually sort of pulled it, towed it along that flat ground to this place in the corner of the soybean field where the farmer that night and that early morning had his guys roll us out a runway. They rolled us on a dirt runway that was probably, I don't know, maybe 20 feet wide and about 2,000 feet long. It was just a flat piece of dirt that he had these big rolling tractors that just rolled us out this big long runway. I had the crop duster looked at me and he said, he goes, well, we do this all the time. He's like, do you want it to fly off of the field or do you want us to do it? I'm like, go for it. Here's my keys, you know, go take the plane and go land it at Cleveland, which is, like I said, 6 miles away.
Wait, this was this the next day?
This was the next day. Ooh. This was the next day.
How is it safe to fly the airplane out if you just had to land with an engine fail? I'm missing a step here.
So the mechanic came out that morning, the next day. So we land in the field, we pull it on the flat part of the field, and the plane sat there in the field overnight. And so we had stayed at a hotel room that was a little down the way in Cleveland. And the next morning, the family of the crop duster picked us up at the airport, drove us back to the soybean field. The mechanic met us out there around, I don't know, 9 o'clock in the morning, did his whole inspection. We called the FAA and they signed us off. I have a logbook entry where the guy said might be the air intake filter. He ran it all the way up. I mean, he had full power with the full brakes set in the on the dirt and the engine sounded great. Fuel pumps worked, everything turned on perfectly fine. And he's like, I can't replicate what happened here on the ground, but I don't see anything wrong. Both your boost pump and your engine driven fuel pump work great. You've got fuel in the tanks. I don't know what happened to you guys in the air. And it was at that point that we had it pulled to this runway that they had created for us.
Okay.
And then once the FAA saw the logbook entry from the mechanic, said airworthy in my mind, if the mechanic can't find the issue with the engine failure, and he signed it off and checked it out, he's like, I'm happy. Yeah. So then the mechanic and the crop duster jumped in the plane and took off the dirt field and landed it at Cleveland Municipal Airport on a real runway.
Oh, the mechanic went with him.
Yep. Huh. Mechanic went with him.
Okay. Well, that's always a comforting feeling.
Oh, yeah. And I asked him afterwards when he landed the plane, I said, you know, I could have flown with the crop duster. And he's like, no. He goes, I couldn't tell what happened here on the ground. But if I can get in the air with the airplane, you know, I know you have gas. So I at least want to see, like, can we recreate what happened to see if there's another issue? And he goes, because I can't see it on the ground.
Yeah.
I mean, I there's nothing in the fuel tanks I can see. You know, he was shining the lights in there, couldn't see it and whatnot. He goes, I don't know. And just to make you feel a little safe, you know, I'll fly it the 10 minutes to the airfield. That's just a little ways away. In fact, when we got to the airfield afterwards too, he said, you know, I couldn't recreate what happened. He goes, I think you guys are probably completely fine filling up the tanks and flying west if you wanted to continue your journey. And that's when I said, no, I'm going to leave it here. I will come back and get it. I want to make sure everything is good with the plane before, you know, I fly west, because I start to run out of landing spots once I get to West Texas.
Yeah. We used to call that issue a C&D, could not duplicate. And we just, I just hate the C&Ds. You know you had a problem. You experienced it. Maintenance, for all of their effort and expertise, you know, sometimes they just can't duplicate it on the ground. And so then you've got a decision to make, you know, I know I had a problem. They can't duplicate it on the ground. Was it just momentary? Is it some kind of sediment or trash in the system or who knows what? But do I have a systemic problem that's going to happen again? Or was it truly just a flash that, you know, is gone? Yeah, that's always an uncomfortable position. But I really admire the guy that your maintenance technician that signed it off, said this plane's airworthy and I'm going to fly in it. I mean, that's just character in my mind.
I mean, those people in the South, I cannot thank them enough. The family that helped us, the, like I said, the crop duster, the farmers on the field, the tractor drivers, the sheriff's department. I mean, they were so accommodating, so graceful with their time, with their hospitality.
Isn't it just so uplifting? Just people in general. I have found that so much in general aviation. I've been stuck a couple of times, one of which was in a thunderstorm, and my son and I had to run next door underneath this funeral home. And the people just couldn't have been nicer to us. You know, it's just incredible the experiences you'll get into when you have these little sort of situations where, you know, you make your plans and life happens. And as life's happening, you can just meet the most incredible people.
Agreed. Totally agree. And, you know, coming from California, you know, not that that says anything about California, but coming from out west, you know, I said, you and your family, I mean, his son drove us all the way to Jackson that very afternoon on the next day so we could commercial flight our way home, which was basically 2.5 hours one way from where we left the plane. I mean, just jumped in his mom's car and said, yep, you know, you guys get in the car. My son's going to drive you down to Jackson and he'll take care of you. And I said to him, I said, you know, hey, I'd like to offer you something. You've done a lot for myself and my buddy here with the plane. And it was so heartwarming and just completely, I was completely speechless when he just looked at me and he says, Jared, welcome to the South. We take care of people, you know?
Yeah, that's just a great story. So Jared, I want to go back to, so as you look back on this event, back when you were flying and the event happened and how you handled it, what are your takeaways? What are your lessons learned? What would you do differently? What would you do the same?
The one thing I would have said to maybe do a slightly different would have been, instead of maybe taking that first hour and a half trip to Kearney, Illinois, would maybe have been to fly around the pattern a little bit in Kokomo. It would not necessarily have perhaps changed the outcome per se, but it might have shown us something while we were there. Maybe it might have felt given us a little bit more comfort with the airplane before we were actually flying someplace. But I don't think that would have changed the outcome in hindsight. If anything, what I would have done differently is I should have thought of going back to the fuel selector and maybe going back to check that before just giving up and deciding that there was nothing else I could do but land it into field. That would be the one thing I might have done a little different.
Yeah, even if that works or only partially works, to be able to know or get yourself a little more power or something. I agree with you, and sitting here at 0 knots and 1G and hearing you recount the story, to say that if your engine's sputtering and you were up at 3,000 AGL or so, to try to isolate it a little bit. Isolate it a little bit, right? So switching fuel tanks is the first thing that comes to mind, checking your mixture setting, checking your boost pump on and off, trying your magnetos, you know, the basic things there, just to see if you can isolate that problem a little bit.
Yep, that would have been the one thing. I agree.
So I would agree with your assessment there, with the caveat that not so much so because we've seen this happen, that people keep fiddling with that stuff all the way until now they've got no time to think like you did. And now they're in a crisis mode and they're making panicked decisions. They limit their options. They don't find a good field. So, you know, it is a balance. You want to check that if you have the time to do it. But if you don't have the time to do it, focus on the landing like you did.
Yeah. And the crazy part about that day putting it in the field was there was another plane that actually went down near Greensville for fuel starvation. I don't know what happened. I don't know if it was a crop duster or if it was a Cessna or something like that or what exactly happened. But we had heard on the radios before we even landed that there was a plane that went down in a field due to fuel starvation. We had heard that over the radio. So apparently this might be a common occurrence. I don't know, but I hope not. But it was kind of interesting to know that we were the second one potentially of the day to have to put an airplane in the field, not because of fuel starvation, but at least just to put it in the field.
Well, I'm curious as to why. So I guess just you landing in the field and jostling, you know, in a rough field, that jarred the sediment loose from the fuel screen or something? Or why did it work when the maintenance guy got in?
No idea. The only thing I can think of is, yeah, the jostling might have moved it and pushed it in a different direction. And I even thought of when we made that turn, that initial turn to get away from the river, because we had picked the field and we kind of got our RPMs back. Because remember, I hadn't switched the tank, so I was still on that same tank. We got some RPMs. So maybe just that slight movement moved that piece of sediment away from the fuel screen just enough where I got some additional fuel in the engine and I was able to climb a little bit. But then the moment it resettled back and I went wings level, it covered up the screen again. So it's possible. I just don't know. Mm. I really don't know.
Yeah. It will remain a mystery, but they found it during the annual inspection, cleaned your tanks. And now, well, tell us the rest of the story. So you finally got the airplane home and do you still have it? How long did you fly it?
Yeah. So another buddy of mine flew with me back to Mississippi and we went and picked up the plane and flew it home in about 3 days. And I still have it. It's here in Executive. It's currently undergoing some maintenance because I need to replace some brake lines on the main landing gear. But otherwise, we brought it back in October of last year. And so, yeah, it's sitting here and looking forward to flying it here soon and definitely flying around California, that's for sure.
So since that one issue, no issues, flew all the way back fine, you've been flying it fine ever since, no issues since then?
No issues. The plane was great flying back all the way across the country. And yeah, we had to get over some high terrain. I mean, we flew into Arizona through Texas, Cavern City, New Mexico. And yeah, it was great. The flight was super smooth. The plane handled great. We even decided on our way out to California to really break up our flight in more about 2-hour-ish chunks instead of these long hauls. Just because it was more comfortable to do so, but because we knew the plane's history, we wanted to make sure we could accommodate quickly if we needed to. So we really created much more stops than we probably needed to, but the plane flew great. It's such a great machine and I'm super comfortable, happy still with my purchase. If anything, that situation in Shelby was a big learning experience in my mind, and as a pilot now who's experienced that on our way home, even I think I was looking for emergency landing spots probably every 20 seconds or so, paying attention to the glide ring on 4Flight, saying, okay, glide ring's here, looking out that, okay, we probably put it over there. There's a road over there. It's now just a constant reaffirmation of trying to find that emergency landing spot, as well as a constant scan over to the fuel pressure gauge. You know, it was great. And the one thing I will say, the mechanic who did my annual even noticed something else that I didn't mention, which was my fuel gauges had been wired incorrectly. So they apparently, when the left tank was full, it would show full tanks in both left and right.
Ooh.
When the right tank was full, it wouldn't show anything. Mm. So he fixed that for me, number one, but I don't think that was it could have been a problem, but at the same time, when we landed in the field, we looked, there's blue liquid in both tanks. So we knew we had gas. And even then, if we had been going by time, which we were, we knew how much should have been in that tank and vice versa. So yeah, the plane flew great home. It's such a fun little airplane to be in. Like I said, I can't wait to take to wife again, to fly in California. It'll be a lot of fun. Looking forward to it.
Well, so happy that it ended successfully and you guys handled that well. Jared, thanks so much for sharing your lessons learned with us and welcome to AOPA. I'm just delighted you're here.
Me too. I'm really happy to be with AOPA. I never thought I could merge my 20 years in politics and working in the state capitol to pursuing a passion that is flying. And this is such a great experience for me to be working with AOPA and to furthering our mission here and on the West Coast. And the one thing I just wanted to add too is if you're a student pilot that's out there, take your training seriously. That's the one thing we both came back to California with was, sure, you do soft field landings on hard surfaces, you know, on big runways and stuff like that, but take it seriously. You never, ever know when you're going to be put in a situation where that training is going to be so valuable.
Good lessons learned there, Jared, and a good observation on your part. Thanks so much for sharing it with us, and I'll see you on the West Coast pretty soon here.
Yes, let's do it soon. Thanks for having me.
Well, that's another off-airport landing with a happy ending, and about 90% or so by industry estimates, about 90% of off-airport landings do not end in a fatality. And that's because, thankfully, GA pilots are trained to handle the situation and predominantly handle them well. Jared certainly did. He got us some good lessons learned to think about and then reinforced the whole issue of take your training seriously, because one day you just may have to put it to use in a real scenario. Thanks for joining us on this edition of There I Was. Alongside our producer, David O'Leary, I'm your host, Richard McSpadden. Until next time, fly safe. Hey, listeners, we want to thank you for making this one of the most popular aviation podcasts there is. Thanks to you, our listeners, for your engagement, for following us, and for your likes and subscribes on whether it's iTunes or Spotify. Those mean a lot to us and help us expand the aviation reach and our aviation safety message. If you'd like to help us and become a supporter of these podcasts, please consider a donation to the AOPA Foundation. That's AOPAfoundation.org. Thanks for your support, and thanks for making this podcast so successful.
There I Was is produced by the AOPA Air Safety Institute. If you'd like to hear other episodes, submit comments, or submit your own story to potentially be featured on the show, please visit airsafetyinstitute.org/thereiwas. Thanks for listening.